Good morning, everyone. I'm Mohammed Syed. I'm head of asset management at Coutts, and I'm delighted to welcome such a large number of clients to this online event. Though we cannot convene in person, it's still important that we act as an indispensable partner to you through these difficult times. This is our first in a series of online events, so please do look out for more invitations in the future. Today, we are honored to have with us very active leaders in the COVID-19 crisis. Sir Paul Nurse, who needs very little introduction, but a Nobel laureate and director and head of the Francis Crick Institute. In just a few short weeks, the Institute has begun delivering COVID-19 testing for NHS staff and pivoted research projects to drive fundamental understanding of the virus. Sarah Woolner, Executive Director of Policy and Information at Cancer Research UK, is at the forefront of supporting and advocating for people living with cancer through this crisis. We all know who has been affected by cancer, and we hope that what you hear today will provide comfort and answers to some of the concerns that you may have. The Francis Crick Institute works in partnership with Cancer Research UK, one of its founding partners, to attract and secure philanthropic support to help discover the biology underlying human disease and accelerate the development of new diagnostics and treatments. Before I hand over to our chairman, Lord William Waldegrave, himself a former Secretary of State for Health, I wanted to mention that we've had a number of questions pre-submitted for this call. As such, we'll be answering some of these rather than a live Q&A for now. We will send out a resource page post this call where you can find links to the latest developments from the Francis Crick Institute. At this stage, I would like to hand over to William.
Thank you, Mo, very much. And it's terrific and a great privilege to us to have Paul and Sarah with us today. Paul, I was lucky enough to be at the official opening of the Francis Crick Institute by the Queen, where I believe the Queen incidentally pressed a button which started the sequencing of your own genome, which is pretty smart. But tell us a little bit about the background to the Institute and the thinking that lay behind it.
Yes, and you know what the Queen said to me? She said, "I hope you don't find out anything that you didn't want to know."
Very good.
Great sense of humour. Yes, indeed. Well, thank you, Mo, and thank you, William, for hosting this event. And we're all very grateful at Cancer Research UK and also at the Crick Institute. So what is the Crick? I'll just give you a short summary before we go over to talking about COVID-19. We are what I call a discovery biomedical research institute, quite large. 1,300 researchers here, although small compared with a great research university, but the biggest institute under a single roof in Europe. So a significant investment in biomedical research from the UK. Although we're a discovery research institute trying to understand the biology underpinning issues of human health, we're also very open to translating those discoveries to creating the public good, in trying to bring our discoveries rapidly, if we can, to serving society. And actually, that frankly is the ethos behind our rapid move into dealing with COVID-19. So what is the concept of the Crick? If I can just rather rapidly run through that. Well, like all institutions, though we take it very seriously, we have a great focus on quality, the highest quality work. Let me just explain how that works. We work through research groups. We have around 100 research groups with research group leaders. About half of those group leaders are senior, like me, and have white hair, and mostly over the age of 40. other half between 30 and 40. And we recruit the best people we can find in the world, and we review them rigorously every 5 years. We don't have tenure like universities do, so we do actually have significant turnover. Just to give you an indication, amongst those 50 senior group leaders, half of them are fellows of the Royal Society, and we have four Nobel Prize winners, four, which is easily one of the best in the entire world in concentration for Nobel Prize winners. So high quality. We're also open and interdisciplinary. And how do we achieve that? One is, and as you saw when you visited, when the Queen opened our building 3 years ago, because we've only been here 3 years, you will have noticed how open plan, how much glass there is, how small the offices are. You could only get two people in my office. We all have to get out into the communal areas to try and promote talking, conversation, interactions, so that we work closer together discussing our issues. So open plan. We have no departments, no divisions. Sometimes people make fun of me and say, there's lots of knights, there's no barons, and there's a king. And what this leads to is, in fact, a lack of fighting between the barons, because as you know from our history, barons are always a problem in all societies. And it also means that the leadership, actually there's more than one king, there's several kings, but the leadership is very close to the coal face. So we actually are very, although large, we're relatively agile. We put a great focus on young group leaders, 30 to 40, recruit around the world. We get at least 100 applicants for each group leader position. It's extraordinary. And so the quality can be maintained. Now, what do we do with them? They actually leave us, these younger researchers, after 10 or 12 years when we develop them, when they're highly creative and often very active, maybe a bit green, but we can give them advice on how to deal with that. And just as they get to their peak, we will actually export them elsewhere. So we act as a pipeline for the UK biomedical research endeavour, or should they go overseas, to create a network over the years that connects Britain with the rest of the world. One final point, we're funded in a number of different ways. Cancer Research UK is our biggest funder. The Medical Research Council, which is the government one step removed, is our second one, almost the same. Between them, they provide over £100 million a year. The Wellcome Trust is a smaller core funder, and we are linked strongly with the three great London universities, University College, Imperial College, and King's College. So that's a snapshot of what the CRIC is.
Brilliant, Paul, thank you. You could describe the thing as being, in current jargon, a super spreader of good science around the world, I think.
Yes,
as well
indeed.
As making a terrific centre here. Now, everybody in the country, in every walk of life, is having to change their way of doing their business at the moment. You, I know, and you were a great president of the Royal Society, a terrific believer in the interaction of people. How have you managed to handle that when we're socially distancing? And how have you managed to...
Mo, should I continue? I could think I know what he was going to ask. Should I continue?
Yes, please. Please do. Yeah, absolutely.
I will. I think what William was about to ask was, how have we responded to the COVID-19 pandemic? What has it meant to our activities? How have we contributed to it? Well, the first thing we did do is we didn't close our laboratories down. We were under some pressure to do so because of the difficulties of containing the infection. But we decided that we should try and keep some activity going. One reason was we needed to look after our resources, but the main reason was that we could then use our resources to help combat the pandemic. And we've done that really in two ways. The first is through testing. Now, we are we're a discovery research lab. We're not a testing lab at all. So this is quite different ways of working. But we realize that we have both the machinery, the lab facilities, and also the skill sets that we could easily, fairly easily, I wouldn't like to say easily, but fairly easily put that in place very rapidly. And so we took that decision. We took that decision in about mid-March when it became clear to us, very clear to us, that testing was crucial, because if you don't know where your enemy is, then you can't fight it. So testing becomes critical. It was also clear that healthcare workers working in our hospitals particularly, but also care homes as well, that healthcare workers were critical to this, because if they have the infection themselves, they will end up spreading that infection to vulnerable patients and also to their colleagues. So you needed to have high quality testing facilities in place that would allow that to be carried out efficiently. The government decided to push more of a policy of mega labs, 2 or 3 mega labs around the country. I use the analogy of Dunkirk to say that the little ships had something to contribute as well as the big ships, the destroyers. And we have set up our testing facility so that we can now manage at least 2,000 tests a day, which is really quite significant. I think in the last few days, the whole country has only been having about 13,000 tests. So it's a significant contribution. It will, of course, once the big ships come on board, then it will become smaller. And what this allows us to do is to test whether healthcare workers are infected and therefore could transmit the disease to their patients. And we are in a position to be able to help University College London hospitals and other North London hospitals to be able to do this. And I want to stress this, we could only do this by working in close collaboration with the NHS hospital, our local University College London hospital, and also their diagnostic laboratory as well, health service labs. And it's only by that local close working that we could get this to work so rapidly and so efficiently, because there's many problems to this. It's not just a lab issue of getting tests through the laboratory, it's also the workflow, how you get the samples from healthcare workers and patients for that matter, how you get them into the laboratory, how you get the information back again. Even at our scale of operation of 1 to 2,000, it's quite a tough order to deliver. And with the bigger labs, I think it will be even more difficult. Well, we've got it working. We are making a contribution. We can fill the gap to the big mega labs fill up. And we can also act as a research facility in this, in trying to get this working more effectively when the bigger labs come on flow. And I think William has now returned.
I have, yes. Sorry.
So I invented your question, William, and I hope I answered what you were going to answer.
Brilliant.
You did indeed. Thanks. You did indeed. Thank you.
So we've dealt with testing and immunity a bit, have we?
Not with immunity. Dealt with was what the CRIC was doing with respect to testing. We haven't discussed the issues of testing yet, which of course we easily could do if you wish.
Could we do that before we come to Sarah? Because I'd like to ask Sarah about the impact of all this on cancer treatment and cancer patients and so on. I listened to Jeremy Farrar, who's on your board, I think, on the television on Monday, where he was saying carefully that there were some doubts about what the immunity status of this thing would be. And of course, that has an impact on producing any kind of vaccine. So what's your feeling about that? I know there aren't any clear answers yet.
Well, I'll just for the sake of the of your audience, I should just say something about the two main tests that are available and what they reveal. Now, the test that we're carrying out is something called a polymerase chain reaction test. What this does is it detects the virus directly itself, in particular the nucleic acid, which is ribonucleic acid RNA. Which is at the core of the virus. And the tests we have put in place detect that. So what they allow us to do is to say, is an individual in at that moment in time, are they infected? And of course, that is directly relevant to if they're infected, to transmitting it to somebody else. The antibody tests detect something different. They detect whether the human body has reacted to the presence of that virus in the past. Have they produced antibodies against the presence of the virus? And furthermore, are those, which is relevant to your question, are those antibodies have given protection and long-term protection? So those two tests are quite different. One is testing whether you're infected now. Another is, have you been infected in the past and responded? Now, both of these tests are needed to be able to monitor the spread of the disease, how quickly it moves from one person to another, and also to help you manage a hospital or manage a healthcare home. You need that information. You also need to know the information if you're going to think of an exit strategy in a number of respects. That is to say, how many of the population have been infected and perhaps have immunity, the so-called infamous herd immunity, which is important because herd immunity does allow an exit strategy. The only problem with it is the cost too much for human life to actually get there? And that's a significant problem, that if you let herd immunity go rip, then of course many people will die. And so this is the difficulty that the NHS and Public Health England have had to be dealing with. But it also helps us with understanding what sort of vaccine may be useful. It might be able to tell you which components in the virus are most critical and most important for raising an antibody response, and also which antibodies which are interacting with those components may be important for developing a vaccine, because it tells you what the right target is. Now, as I think you hinted, we don't know the answers to these questions. And that's what Jeremy Farrow was emphasizing. I think we will get the answers to those problems, but it will take some time. And what we're reading about, and maybe it, those in the audience sometimes get confused about it. Some say we can have a vaccine by September, others say 18 months. I think it will be a little more difficult than September, if you want my view about it. Hopefully it won't be as long as 18 months. But until we know the basic biology of this of COVID-19 virus, and until we know how the human body responds to that virus, we cannot plan out a good exit strategy. So we are flying blind. I'm a pilot, so I'm used to flying blind. And frankly, we are flying a bit blind. But we have many people across the world working on this and trying to work out very rapidly how the biology works and how we might take it forward.
Well, if I'm going to have a pilot flying me blind, I'm glad it's you, Paul, frankly. could we, you've mentioned, you've implied the huge pivot that's been made in your work, and rightly, and right back to the Cooksey report, you were driven by the idea of getting things that would actually help people and out into the community, which puts you in the front line here. But obviously, all those people, and cancer is still one of the greatest killers of all, we mustn't forget about them. Now, how, and I'd love to hear Sarah's view on this as well. Presumably, your underlying work on cancer, and your own work was crucial to that, is continuing as well. And because we can't save the people from coronavirus and then find we've got more people who've died with cancers that we could have treated and so on.
Well, you're quite right. My own work was closely related to cancer, and I worked for Cancer Research UK. Well, actually ran it for a while, I mean, many years ago. But my work was on understanding how cells control their division from 1 to 2, which is the basis of cancer. But I think I'd like to pass straight over to Sarah, who can actually put the work in cancer in perspective with the COVID infection, and then I can come back if there's anything that needs to be filled in. So Sarah, could you deal with that?
Yes, of course, and thank you very much for having me. So perhaps if I start by giving a brief picture of what's happening to cancer treatment and how Cancer Research UK is responding to that. William, as you made clear, I mean, cancer is a disease that touches us all. One in two of us will be diagnosed with cancer at some point in our lifetime. 160,000 people die in the UK of cancer each year. So, you know, the scale of the challenge is clear. Cancer Research UK, just like the CRIC, is having to pivot to respond to COVID-19. And one of the ways I've been most involved in that is really understanding what's happening to cancer patients, what's happening to treatment and care across the UK, and doing our best as Cancer Research UK to support patients, but also to shine a spotlight on service difficulties, treatment difficulties back to NHS England and devolved nations governments. So, I mean, the reality is cancer treatment is severely disrupted. Many cancer patients are at increased risk of infection from COVID-19 and therefore will need to be careful in how they're accessing treatment, in how they're planning visits to hospitals and so on. But of course, there is this extra issue of capacity difficulties within the health service because of the national response to COVID-19. So what we are seeing is that quite a lot of cancer treatment is being delayed or disrupted. And of course, that's hugely distressing to cancer patients. About 200,000 cancer patients are designated in the very vulnerable group and should have received letters from government to encourage them to shield. And of course, extra help and support will be needed for that group. But so what we are seeing across the country, not only is cancer treatment being disrupted, delayed, postponed, but also we've seen this radical drop in the number of patients presenting with cancer signs and symptoms at a GP surgery. We also see many of the screening programs being paused and screening services disrupted. Now, that's an issue because we know in the UK already we have a problem with late cancer diagnosis. And indeed, Cancer Research UK has been at the forefront of efforts over the past decade or so to encourage earlier diagnosis. If you compare cancer survival rates in the UK to those of comparable health systems, the best performing health systems in the world, we don't do as well. And our hypothesis is we often diagnose late and then suboptimally treat. So there's been a mammoth national effort to try to diagnose early. And what we're seeing at the moment, when I'm speaking to clinical leaders across the country, they describe things as being eerily quiet in GP surgeries, you know, akin to the Christmas period. We see 2-week wait referrals, so that's where a GP urgently suspects cancer, down at about 30% of what would normally be expected. So what we're storing up is quite a lot of demand and need in the community, and that's something we're going to have to deal with when the peak of COVID-19 is over. But just a word more on treatment disruption. So we have been working very closely with the NHS to develop new guidance and with many of the Royal Colleges, the surgeons, the radiologists and so on, to give some priority in these extraordinary times to try to ensure that essential cancer treatment does continue. A new model has been suggested and is already operational in some parts of the country. And essentially, the idea is you treat cancer patients in cancer clean hubs or cleanish, so free of COVID wherever possible. And the message from the NHS is very much essential cancer treatment should continue, particularly surgery, where there's a very good chance of cure. So if cancer is caught early and you can resect, that's your best chance of cure. But just perhaps a word or two more about what Cancer Research UK is doing. So we have been leading efforts across the community to really understand what's going on the ground. And I think to be frank, there is a bit of dissonance between what we're hearing at national level and what's happening on the ground. So the message that cancer treatment should continue as far as possible is being received. The reality on the ground in some parts of the country is there are capacity issues. It's difficult to create COVID clean hubs. There's a plan to use the independents as sector and private providers. That works better in some parts of the country than others because of the capacity that's available. So we've been trying to be an honest broker, a sort of critical friend of government, and really understanding what's happening on the ground and feeding that back and liaising with many of the national bodies because we have sort of good vantage point and we fund about 4,000 researchers, clinicians and so on across the UK.
Well, that's terrific work. And I suppose I'm a typical person. I'm in that age group where I have a regular bowel cancer screening. All that's been postponed for this year. I was just coming up to do it. And so one doesn't want all that early work to be disrupted one wants it to be disrupted as little as possible in the medium term, I guess, let alone the immediate treatment of people who need it now. So your work is vital on that.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we're very quickly getting to the point of saying, you know, the priority over the past month has been we must continue as much cancer treatment as possible. You know, our headline is, well, cancer doesn't stop during COVID-19. Right. But we're quite quickly getting to the point of saying you must plan for post the peak. So particularly when it comes to screening and what's happening in primary care. And there is a huge effort now underway, but we must hold feet to the fire on this to make sure that we capture all the people who may have missed screening appointments or may have got into the early stages of the system, but haven't had their diagnosis, don't have their treatment plan, or their treatment hasn't yet begun, or it's been paused. We must get back to as much service, business as usual, as quickly as we can. And just a linked point, it links back to what Paul was saying. Testing is absolutely critical to this. So what we are hearing right across the UK is, look, staff are obviously isolating at home where they suspect COVID. Many of them aren't getting tested. But the way that you get cancer treatment and in fact, treatment for many other diseases and conditions back up and running as best we can is to have a pretty comprehensive screening program for patients, but also healthcare workers, because what's beneath some of this drop in demand, we know many people are anxious about going to hospital, anxious about accessing healthcare, and a way to reassure them is to say, you know, if you're a cancer patient with a suppressed immune system, it is still safe to go in for cancer treatment in a certain facility.
Quite. Well, the scaling up of the testing capacity and the swab testing and all that is going to be absolutely crucial for you and your work and right across the health service and the care services in general. So perhaps we could go back to Paul for a moment, just to see if there's anything you wanted to comment on what Sarah has said, Paul.
Well, firstly, just to back up what Sarah said, this pandemic isn't only a problem with this virus. It's a problem with its interaction with all sorts of other diseases and the treatment and management of those diseases. Mm. And key and crucial for that is cancer. And I emphasize that we need to understand more about the biology of this disease, the transmission and basic facts to work out those strategies. Let me just give you one simple example. We don't really know what percentage of healthcare workers are infected. And so how can we deliver COVID-free areas in the hospital when we don't know that whether those who are working in that hospital are COVID-free or not? So without comprehensive testing and reliable testing very regularly, we can't actually devise strategies that allow cancer treatments and so on to go ahead. And it may be that only 5% of healthcare workers are infected. It may be 90% are infected. And it really is as unknown as that. And until we have that information, we cannot have a sensible strategy. So we have to work hand in hand in trying to work that out. And somewhere like the CRIC, which is a research facility, can not only therefore help with the actual testing, but can do research on the information that comes back that could advise policy throughout the country. Yeah. We already had an influence because I think there was on policy because there was not enough emphasis on the more local ways of doing this. That has shifted government policy, I think. And now what we have to do is shift government policy so that there is testing and we can provide a research engine to actually inform how that can be best put in place.
Right. And of course, it was probably right of, I can't remember who it was who said it, I think it was one of, I think it was my successor. I'm jolly glad not to be in his job just at the moment, thank you. But a bad test is worse than no test in some sense. The tests have got to be reliable. So the sort of work that you do to make sure that they are the highest level of reliability is crucial too, I guess.
It's absolutely crucial. The PCR test, the one that we've been doing, is reliable, but you've got to make sure that the workflow is reliable too. That's something that often isn't emphasized enough. And for a pointy-headed scientist like me, we don't normally think about things of that sort. But you have to make sure that the samples are properly collected, that they're properly delivered, that the information is gathered, goes back. Now, this is easier locally than it is with centralized facilities, but you've no idea how tough it is to get the workflow. And indeed, we're not working at capacity yet, simply because we haven't got the workflows in place. And so that's absolutely critical in trying to get the whole testing in place. Not just the lab work, but everything in front of the lab work, everything behind the lab work.
That's fascinating. And one of the big lessons, I guess, that the whole world is going to learn from this episode is that though science and intellectual effort is international and completely, I've always tried to resist talking about British science. You know, there is science done in Britain and the science done all around the world, and it's all the same thing. And that flows instantly, but manufacturing capacity doesn't, and logistical capacity doesn't. So that we're going to have to look at being a little bit more resilient locally, I think, in the future, aren't we?
Well, I think so. I mean, the way I sort of view it is that we need everybody doing something. If you have a lot of local, or at least some local initiatives like ours, we will learn about best practice. Somebody working in Birmingham will learn about their best practice. We won't do it exactly the same, but out of that, much more rapidly than trying to do it too top down, in my view at least, we will be able to get a more efficient and effective process and more resilience, exactly as you say.
I'm sure that's a lesson that's going to be relearned against across all sectors, actually. But I'm right, aren't I? And just going to the other extreme of cooperation. I mean, there have been lots of things said about the Chinese and so on and so forth, but the actual international scientific cooperation has been working extremely well, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And sometimes I think science gets a bad name, that we don't collaborate, we just all compete all the time. You know, that is basically unfair. Of course, there's some competition, but that only keeps standards up most of the time. But there's a lot of openness in discussing things, a lot of collaborations and softer collaboration, interactions, talking, batting the thing around. And what we've seen here, which is very interesting, is that because this is such an important area, we're seeing many places throughout the world, including our own institute here, doing some work on COVID. So what is particularly different here, I think, is maybe not so much collaboration, because I think that was probably okay. It's more that there's many, many people trying to do the same thing, and they're not trying to get famous with it.
They're trying to
achieve an objective for the good of society. And that, I think, is one of the bright lights of this whole thing here that we can actually take some pleasure in.
Yeah. How do you manage, and because you've emphasized, and I love it, the face-to-face nature of the design of the Crick Institute, which is a symbolic of it, and it's the concept of the ancient university, really, that you put people together and they interacted. I love the story that one of my heroes, Richard Feynman, who couldn't go to Harvard because there was a quota for Jews in those days and it was full, so he had to go to MIT, and he was mixed up with a lot of engineers, and that was very good for him, actually. He learned all sorts of things from the engineers. Now, How do you manage your people when they can't actually be face-to-face? So they're all Zooming, I suppose.
We're all Zooming at the moment. And that is quite interesting because Zooming is good, but it isn't really quite good enough, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there's far too much travel and conferences and so on, but there is something about being in the same room with a collection of people that is the most effective way of doing it. Now, we have to do what we do, which is Zooming, as we're doing today. And also, there's many more mundane things that can be done without being in the same room. But really, creative thought, real intellectual challenge, and looking at the body language, making sure everybody's involved, I'm afraid we're going to have to be in the same room, perhaps 2 meters apart, but certainly in the same room.
Well, we've got to test the scientists too, so that the ones who are free of it can begin to go back to the older practices.
Yes, indeed. Now, we could test our own scientists, in actual fact, and let's hopefully we can get to that position. But let me just emphasize a particular point you were saying about Richard Feynman. Mm. The mixing of different disciplines is key to science and it's key to COVID. Mm. And, intellectuals can get very balkanized. Mm. They have their little disciplines. You've noticed that I said at the beginning, we didn't allow academic divisions or academic disciplines. Mm. We mix everybody up. And if you mix people up in a good culture, which is also critical for this, then you rub off on each other, you get different critical challenges, and you look at the interfaces between disciplines and new things come about. And that's what the CRIC is trying to do, but it is also important for tackling COVID-19.
Absolutely must be right, that. And the principles behind your institute are spot on. Could I go to Sarah on another point, slightly going off at a tangent, but it's another kind of vital thing to think about at the moment. We have a lot of the people who are calling into this call today will be involved with a whole range of different charities. And they've had, I know this from my own experience, all sorts of events have been cancelled and fundraisers have gone. There's that wonderful Captain Horn, who's raised £15 million, but walking up and down his garden, it just shows that what a guy, and shows that the willingness to give is that. But Sarah, how do we and how do charitable institutions come through this and mitigate the impact on their own fundraising? How are you thinking about that?
Yes, well, it's a good question because the charitable sector has taken a very significant and immediate hit. So to give you a bit of context from Cancer Research UK's perspective, we believe at least a 25% reduction in fundraised income this year, which is about £125 million. And to give you a sense of how that breaks down, well, Cancer Research UK has 600 shops across the UK. Of course, they are all closed. That's about £9 million a month. All of our mass fundraising events, so the running events and cycling events and so on, of course, have all been paused. Our legacy income stream is down. So lots of charities will have taken a very immediate and very severe hit. So we're anticipating at least a 25% drop. That's not worst case. We are having to take a number of immediate steps to reduce our costs in the short term, and lots of other charities will have to be thinking about that. To give you a flavour of that, we, along with many others, are trying to take advantage of the government's packages where we can. So we're furloughing a lot of staff. We have the executive board has taken a 20% pay cut. We're in consultation with the rest of staff about that. There's a very short-term, immediate package of things we're trying to do to reduce costs. We are also having to take the very difficult decision to make some immediate cuts to our research. So Cancer Research UK funds, of course, we're a large funder of the CRIC, but we fund between £400 and £500 million worth of research each year. Cancer Research UK funds about half of the cancer research that happens across the UK. And we fund a lot of the infrastructure. So we fund through other institutes, through 14 centres across the UK. We fund a lot of the clinical research infrastructure. And despite best efforts, we have already had to announce nearly £50 million worth of cuts. And we're trying to administer those, obviously, to reduce the impact, particularly trying to protect younger career support that we give to more junior researchers. But across our institutes and centres, we've taken between a 5 and 10% cut and stopped response mode funding, at least in the first part of this year. So it's very difficult. It's very difficult and challenging. What are we trying to do about it positively? Well, just a point to build on what Paul has said about the CRIC. So I have to say the response across the cancer research community has been phenomenal. Very much building on what the CRIC has done. We have other Cancer Research UK institutes and centres that are either sending a lot of staff to COVID testing hubs and offering up skilled workforce, or indeed trying to turn our own centres and institutes into testing hubs, sort of building on what the CRIC has done. We have teams who are monitoring virus models and trying to understand how the virus spreads, and then absolutely critically for us, of course, trying to understand the interaction between COVID-19 and cancer, and trying to build a picture and learn from the published literature about how the virus interacts with cancer treatment and learn lessons from that. On the philanthropy side of things and from a fundraising perspective, we're trying the full gambit of things to make sure that the drop we see isn't so severe. So we are encouraging people to do things at home that they may have done out and about. We've got a virtual race for life, even a virtual marathon that people can work on in their back garden. We have things like online quizzes and so on. And we will be going out with some kind of emergency appeal. I've seen lots of charities already go out. I think something we're also reflecting on is, you know, we have a lot of valued, highly valued existing supporters who are close to Cancer Research UK and understand the cause. And I think for lots of charities at times like this, going to some of your most valued supporters, explaining the situation and asking them to help out at this time is certainly an avenue we want to explore. I think the final thing is, when we get back to some form of normality, thinking about how as a charity we adjust our business model, but also think about new ways to fundraise and how we sort of engage with people off the back of it. Something I reflect on is, you know, science is going to be the way out of COVID-19. And at Cancer Research UK is a scientific organisation that funds, you know, the best cancer research we possibly can, the best research in the world in many cases. And so I'm hopeful that when we get through this, people will still feel motivated by Cancer Research UK's core mission, which is to find a scientific answer to cancer.
Well, I'm going to be quite direct in this. All of us who work at Coutts have the formidable ghost of Angela Burdett Coutts looking over our shoulder, who owned the bank in the 19th century and was probably Britain's first great philanthropist, really, in a whole range of different things. So we hope that some of the magic dust from Angela will fall not only on Coutts employees who can be very generous, but on our clients too. So I hope that some of those listening will be moved to help you. Now, we've covered a little bit about vaccines, and Paul answered earlier about not being too optimistic, but not too pessimistic either, on the reality of when they will come, the two different kinds of testing. Now, the other really scary thing at the moment is the number of people in the ICUs who are actually dying, which is pretty high. So what about therapeutics? Is the CRIC engaged in that sort of work too, looking at drugs, existing drugs that might be useful, looking at existing treatments that might help actually to get a better outcome when somebody gets the disease seriously?
So we are not directly looking at drugs. I can tell you that others are. They have to focus really on drugs that have been tested already, because otherwise it cannot be fast enough, which can be repurposed for treatment against COVID-19. Now, the reason we don't get directly involved in this is that this is essentially clinical trial stuff that has to go on in a hospital. We're more at the discovery end with respect to drugs, but that's going to be far too slow to deal with anything in this respect. And so, but there are clinical trials going on with a variety of different therapeutic agents around the world, actually, to try and repurpose pre-existing drugs to see if they may have some effect on COVID-19. Right. And let me just emphasize the difficulty that CRUK, Cancer Research UK, has been having that Sarah explained. I mean, they really have, I think, about a 25% cut. They really do need support. They've protected us, but even we've had a 5 million cut already. And and of course, we have no money to support testing either. That's not what we're supported for. Now, I'm hoping that we can get that from somewhere else, but took the decision to divert our money for testing that actually had been given for another purpose. And I mean, I decided we needed to do that, but I hope I keep my job at the end of it.
I think you will.
Well, Sarah, William, go on. Yeah, just a word on therapeutics. So because Cancer Research UK does have clinical research infrastructure and expertise, we have been in conversation with the government about offering some of that up for COVID-19 clinical trials. And I do know of a couple of cancer drugs that are being looked at with the potential to repurpose to see if they, you know, they can offer an effective therapeutic option for COVID-19. So to echo what Paul says, there's a lot of work going on. Hopefully Cancer Research UK can offer a contribution.
Right.
And if I may ask Paul and Sarah, on the therapeutics, because it's so pertinent, because everyone looks at social media, reads about all these drugs that people are working on around the world. What's that coordinated collaboration that you see across boundaries on therapeutics, or is it really still very localized?
Well, I'm no expert in this area because, as I said, it's more straightforward clinical research, but I suspect it'll be mostly localized, but localized in a more expansive sense of pharmaceutical companies working with academics, working with charities, working with the hospitals to try and get something going together. I know that there is a lot of contact between those that are putting drugs on cells outside the body and seeing a response that, for example, that the virus is replication is being inhibited, and then that can immediately be transferred to a clinical setting. So there is a lot of interaction, but I think it's either local geographically or local intellectually, in the sense it's where there's already been pre-existing connections. Sarah herself may have some more examples from the CRUK translational labs, but I suspect that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a great deal to add. I think where there are existing strong relationships, so as an example, Cancer Research UK works very closely through our drug discovery efforts with a number of pharmaceuticals, AstraZeneca being one of them. And so where there are existing strong relationships, there will be good collaborations. But I think the speed that is necessitated and the speed at which some of this activity is getting underway will inevitably lead to some more localized activity. One hopes with sort of very, very, very good and quick sharing. And something we've observed is in trying to begin to collate the cancer COVID-19 evidence, so looking at the published literature, for example, coming out of Wuhan about how cancer patients have fared. Increasingly, there's published literature coming out of other countries as well. The sort of rapid nature of sharing and trying to collectively draw lessons so that to therefore inform how we continue to treat patients has been, you know, something to feel very positive and optimistic about. So as an example, if you you know, one of the things we've been most concerned about is where there is potentially a curative cancer surgery being put on hold for too long, so that the operation becomes more difficult, the cancer is more advanced. And actually the background risk for many patients is no greater than if they weren't a cancer patient, which yeah. indicates it's definitely worth doing the surgery. And so quickly learning the lessons and being able to adapt those into policy is so important.
And just to add to that, if I may, William, we are in a negotiation with Cancer Research UK, have been for the last 6 months, to actually move a significant component of their drug discovery translational activities into the CRIC. That's mm-hmm. where their laboratories are going to be hopefully located. In fact, it's been put off by COVID. So in the future, when this comes up, we will be in a much better position to be able to right. work closer with drug discovery laboratories. So that was something we saw would be important, but isn't actually helping us at this moment with the pandemic.
It's great. Great. That's good news. Now, I wanted to ask one other. I love the story that you have these Dutch lens makers in the 17th century, and because they want to go trading and they make telescopes. And then somebody gives a telescope to Galileo and you invent modern astronomy. Now, the equivalent of the lens makers now are the AI people. I mean, we're doing really, really smart things out there with AI. Is there a crossover? Are the tools that they can provide you with giving you greater power?
Yes, they are. So I can comment a little on that. We have Google DeepMind. We're located, by the way, central London, next to St. Pancras, King's Cross. Just on the other side of the station is Google DeepMind. The director of Google DeepMind is I've known for 25 years. His wife was my graduate student, actually. And he is on our scientific advisory board. So we already have links and we're strengthening links. We are already looking, using more machine learning, to be quite honest, than actual artificial intelligence. I know machine learning is often put under the umbrella of AI, but machine learning to look at simulations to track how virus outbreaks spread within and between cities. And we already have a project actually starting on that as a consequence of the pandemic. So we are working with people like Google DeepMind, we work with others, and I'm also trying to embed this type of thinking more generally across our laboratory. So even we in my laboratory have some impact from these ways of analyzing. So you're quite right, William. It's very important to make use of all technologies and thinking, and machine learning and artificial intelligence is one that we really need to exploit across the board in biomedical research.
Right. Well, it's incredibly cheering, I think, to those of us who are lay people to think of this fantastic cross-disciplinary effort that's going on all around the world. And we're very proud of the fact that we have one of the great new centres. And it's wonderful to see that we're used to having ancient things like the Royal Society being the oldest of all the great academies. But here you are with one of the newest great centres in the world. And we're proud of that. And we're extremely proud of what you and your partners are doing. And can I just end, Paul, by when times are tough, one wants some hope as well. It's going to be difficult getting out of this, but we're going to get through this, aren't we, with all this intelligence and all this work that's going on?
Yes, we are going to get through it. And sometimes I think when we're listening to all this information on radio, television, media, which can sometimes be really very gloomy, and you know, we're facing Armageddon. We, as a species, have been resilient. We, as a country, have been resilient. And if we work together, and we work as a community, and if we put all our shoulders to the wheel, we will get through this, and there will be suffering. And I don't want to underestimate the problem. The problem is there, but the problem is beatable. The problem is one that we can solve. I mean, it's one that requires intellect, it requires practicality, it requires passion to get through it. I have to be honest, it's quite different from the sort of more populist things that are coming from parts of the world, which are simply hollow and don't tell us anything. We have to be serious about this, but with that commitment, we will for sure get through it. We will learn something, we weren't properly prepared, but yes, we will prevail.
That's terrific, Paul.
That's terrific. Thank you so much. I think we're coming pretty much to the end. We did take a number of questions, which actually William has asked through the course. Some of our clients have more questions too. We'll try and collate them and pass them on. If Sarah, you had any last comments before I sort of close off, please?
Well, to thank you for hosting this session. I think to build on what Paul has said, you know, sitting at the heart of a scientific organisation, seeing the enthusiasm to respond, to want to be part of the solution, you know, our 4,000 strong community coming together, pivoting very quickly to try to help the COVID response effort, certainly gives me hope that we absolutely will get through this. And then from a health service point of view as well, a leaving thought to make you feel optimistic, talking to clinicians out there on the ground, some of the changes that we've been trying to drive through in cancer treatment and surgery, quite frankly, cancer treatment for years, can happen in a matter of weeks when minds are really concentrated. So as an example, the need to keep patients out of hospital as much as possible is leading to the sort of service innovation that we've known is probably good for patients, but that we haven't quite managed to get over the line. So you do see in these tough times moments of opportunity. And I would just reflect that at Cancer Research UK, the response, the enthusiasm, the willingness to help, and the feeling that in order to beat cancer, we need to beat COVID-19 is shining through, and it is cheering.
Absolutely brilliant. William, did you have any last questions or?
No, I mean, I've always been a terrific fan of Paul's leadership of the whole of what I refuse to call British science, really, of that division of science across the world, which Britain has been a major and remains a major contributor to, thanks to people like him. And I'm so pleased that you, Mo, and many others have been able to help him and Sarah and all the other partners of the CRIC, which is a terrific battalion in this army of seeing us through this trouble.
No, absolutely. Thank you so much. You know, it's been a real privilege, Paul, to be working with you and Sarah as well with Cancer Research UK. And as you know, I got involved just before the building actually went up. And it's been an incredible journey to see British science and science at absolutely its best. And then the manifestation of how you work collaboratively across all the disciplines without having the siloed approach that you mentioned. And on COVID, I think it gives us lots of comfort from hearing from both of you, and particularly the research fraternity, on the amount of effort and the direction of resources that's taking place. And as you quite rightly, Paul, pointed out, you know, what your original mandate was, you've had to pivot, shift, and you addressing, you know, a pandemic. And when you see that across the globe, all the research institutes working at it, from Rockefeller to Weizmann to, you know, people in Far East, it is a tremendous hope to see that we will come out of this. And as you quite rightly said, you know, it will be painful. It's not going to be sometime soon, but there is hope, and we will all come out of this together. So on that note, may I please thank all the clients in particular for taking the time to listening to us. I hope you found it useful. We'll be following up with an email which will direct you to both, hopefully, Cancer Research UK, but also the Francis Crick Institute. But most of all, please stay safe and stay at home. And please look after yourself. And thank you very much to our host, and particularly to Sir Paul and to Sarah. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all.